supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a question of the week that we're calling composting Cub Scouts. Don't worry, we're using it as an adjective, helping the Scouts do some really good composting workshops with our SAGE suggestions. Mostly, however, it is a show filled with your fascinating phone calls to 1-888-346-9499. Patty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Patty. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
Very good. And where is Patty good?
Edmond, Oklahoma. We are a part of the metro Oklahoma City area.
We know all about you Normans and Edmonds and Oklahoma Cityans. Some of our best listeners are in the Oklahoma City area. What can we do for Patty from OK?
I would like to know how to safely kill grub worms, especially in my flower bed area. We have a local lawn service, and they do a great job. They do a liquid spray on our fescue and our Bermuda, and they're nice about staying away from my little bird feeders, but I'm still worried that that's poison.
Oh, yeah. If there hasn't been any arrangement with them to spray a non-toxic grub control, of which there are several. No, they're spraying something like GrubX, which is wrong for several reasons. First, it only works for a single season. And second, It poisons the soil. And what else is in the soil? Earthworms. What do birds eat when it rains and they come close to the surface is earthworms. So no, there is absolutely no reason to treat any lawn with any kind of chemical. And one thing I always like to say about the world of organics is not only can we do anything that a chemical control can do, but our stuff is so much cooler. One of the oldest organic controls is a substance called milky spore disease. And you've seen this in garden centers. It's widely available. They sell it in the spring. Unfortunately, it doesn't work in the spring. It does work right now. Milky spore is a naturally occurring soil organism that was actually discovered in Japan after Japanese beetles got out of control in the United States. Our USDA researchers went over, this was before the war, and studied soil organisms and found out why Japanese beetles were so rare in Japan. There was this disease in the soil that kept their numbers very low. So that was isolated, concentrated, and it's been sold in the United States for over 50 years. It only works when the soil is over 70 degrees, that's as measured 4 inches down, and when grubs are actively feeding on the roots of plants. So in the spring, the soil's too cold, but right now the soil is the perfect warmth, and we're right at the time where grubs have reached a very large, what's called instar. They go through a lot of pupal stages. They're really tiny. They're like the size of a grain of rice in the beginning. But they morph into these big grubs that we're used to seeing. So milky spore applied to either a lawn or flower beds at this time of year will work its way into the soil. If a grub ingests a single spore, it not only dies, but it becomes a milky spore factory, spreading the so-called infection throughout the soil. But it only affects grubs. It won't harm earthworms. It won't harm cicada larvae, people, pets, frogs, toads, birds, aliens, nothing. It harms nothing else. It is so direct. And now there is a brand new organic option that is only available this year. It's exclusive to Gardens Alive, and we always want to have a disclaimer, Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week, but they also are on the cutting edge of helping develop a lot of these new products. And this is a new form of BT, which is another soil-dwelling organism that's isolated and concentrated. This is called BTG for Galleria, and they have a liquid form that you can spray on plants that are under attack by any beetle. That's Japanese beetles, June beetles, rose chafer beetles, and even beetles outside of the scarab beetle family. And as soon as they eat the sprayed leaves, they'll die. So you can, you have a great control for the adults now. And again, it harms nothing else in the environment. And they call that version beetle juice. And but they also have one that's meant for application to a lawn or flower beds. And that's okay. called Grub Halt. And it works very much like Milky Spore. If a lawn grub, a beetle grub, a flower garden grub ingest a single spore of this BT, they stop feeding and die instantly. And again, there's no harm to anything else in the environment. Quite honestly, you don't want to be walking on a lawn that was sprayed right. with grub-killing chemicals.
Right. I'm stopped going barefoot.
Yeah. So your two choices are either Milky Spore disease, which is widely available in garden centers, or Grub Halt from Gardens Alive. And we're going to be hearing a lot more about this BT that affects these beetles, because it also seems to be stopping some of the imported beetles that are killing trees. This could be one of the most important organic discoveries of all time. Yeah, and this is the first year it's available, so your timing is excellent.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Patty. Go and sin no more.
Okay, have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Pete, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. I'm your neighbor to the south down in Wilmington, Delaware.
Very good. What can we do for Pete in the small wonder?
I've got a couple small garden beds, and my cucumbers, zucchinis, and tomatoes have just about reached their life expectancy. So I've never done any fall plantings, and I'm wondering, is it too late to start something, and what are the types of things I could plant? Because I've heard lettuce is a decent crop for the fall, but I don't know anything really else beyond that.
Well, two things. First of all, thank you for bringing up the tomatoes, cucumbers, and stuff, because this is the time of year where it's good for me to tell people, if you have new flowers forming on your tomatoes especially, just go out and pick them off, because they're not going to have time to develop into ripe fruit. And I like your concept that you've gotten enough tomatoes and cucumbers and you're ready to be done with them. That's always better than fighting it out to the bitter end.
Right.
And yes, fall is a great time for planting. I started my first runs of lettuce and spinach a couple of weeks ago, but you still have plenty of time. All you need to do is, take some plants out of what I presume are your raised beds, level the soil, water the soil well, really saturate it with water, and then spread, go out and buy a lot of lettuce seed and spread it thick like a lawn, and then cover that with about 1/4 inch of a nice loose soil-free mix, like a seed starting mix. And then just gently mist the surface of the soil. That's one reason we really saturate the undersoil so much, so that the ground is already wet. Because if you just water like a crazy man after that, it knocks the seed all over the place. And within 5-6 days, the lettuce is going to sprout. And then just let it keep going. And by the time it gets to be, 3, 4, 5, 6 inches, just start cutting it with scissors to get those really small baby greens you see in the store.
Sure.
That's the best way to harvest lettuce. Just go out and cut it right into your salad bowl. Don't pull it out of the ground. Leave about 1 inch attached to the root system. And if we have a warm fall, that lettuce will continue to grow. You can make 2 or 3 cuttings of the same patch. It'll regrow. And because we're getting into cooler weather, the lettuce won't turn bitter. In your climate down in Wilmington, if we get a gentle winter for a change, it'll survive over the winter, and you can even harvest it again in the spring.
In the spring again, wow.
In the spring.
I wasn't expecting that.
If you want to invest in something like a simple row cover, then it's almost guaranteed some of it's going to survive.
Just to keep the frost off.
Yeah, exactly. Just a spun polyester row cover. The big brand name is Rime.
Well, that sounds great. That's some good advice, Mike, and I know what I'm doing this weekend then.
I love the second season. This is the most fun because it's starting to get cool out. These are great crops. They're a lot less picky than the boys this summer. It's a lot of fun, man.
Well, that's great. I look forward to it. I'll give you an update once things start sprouting.
All right. Get planting, Petey.
Thanks, Mike.
Take care, man.
We'll see you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear on Friday evening, September 11th, at a fundraiser for the Spring City Library in Chester County and at the Horsham Township Library on Wednesday evening, September 16th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to Compost Cub Scouts and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a new workshop has Cub Scouts punching holes in metal trash cans. What are they thinking? When we get to the question of the week, we'll tell you, and we'll suggest some revisions that'll help these Cub Scouts make really good compost without destroying any trash cans in the process. In the meantime, though, it's nothing but your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Deborah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello.
Glad to be on the show today.
Well, thank you, Deborah. Where are you?
I'm in California.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a pretty big state. I have been to every part of California, from the Coronado all the way up to the very tippy top of the Redwood Forest. What part of the beautiful state of California is Deborah in?
I'm in Rockland, California.
Now, where is that? I'm not familiar with that.
That's close to Sacramento, 20 miles.
Oh, okay, good.
North of Sacramento.
All right, what can we do for Deborah near Sacramento?
Well, I just recently purchased a house, and on the property is an old olive tree. The house was built in 1890, so I'm assuming the tree is that old because it's massive. And it also has a pomegranate tree. I don't think it's that old, but I was wondering, how can I harvest these olives, and what is the best way to cure them? As far as the pomegranate tree goes, how can I maintain it without harming the roots or trim it back because it is overgrown?
Both of these trees like some pruning, but you don't want to be messing with the roots. You're pruning the tops of the tree. So it's, you have a massive old olive tree that was never trained into like a good branching structure, right?
Correct.
Now, have you been there long enough to experience the olive drop?
Yes, 1 year.
Okay. So, I mean, that's when they're ripe. I mean, there's a lot of trees that are helpful like this. When the olives start to drop, that's when they're ripe. And then you can either wait for them to drop and harvest them daily, or when a significant number of them are dropping, you can, you know, reach up for, quote, the low-hanging fruit. And some people would even suggest shaking the tree if you want to get a bunch of helpers over on a certain day and make short work of it. You know, shake the tree and then have people there with baskets, because I'm presuming you get quite a few olives.
Yes. And the best way to cure them would be to...
These are odd fruits, olives, because they must be treated before you can eat them. They're just too bitter otherwise.
Yes.
And there's two ways to, quote, cure them. One is in a bath of lye, which, you know, I have all kind of issues with, because what are you going to do with the lye when you're done with it? I mean,
correct,
it's a dangerous substance. It can cause burns. It can discolor your skin. I don't see any reason to go there, especially when the true traditional way and what an organic grower would do is in brine. Mix up a good solution of brine, maybe with some kosher pickling salt, and then soak the olives in there in big 5-gallon buckets. Now, the part that I'm not quite sure about is how long you soak them, but you can find that information online. But yes, after the olives are ripe and they fall from the tree easily, you have to soak them in the brine. And then when they come out, you'll like double rinse them. You know, you can use that first brine water, the salty water, to kill any weeds on your property that you don't like.
Oh, fabulous. I like that.
Yeah, salt water is an ancient herbicide. So if there's plants you don't want, just pour that kind of pickling water on top of them, and especially with your dry climate, it'll knock them out. And the pomegranate, you say, is not as large, it's not as out of control?
Well, it's bushy. It is, there's a lot of branches. They're bearing fruit right now, so I don't want to prune away, but it is taking a huge section of the yard, and the fruit is weighing the branches down. So I'm not quite sure how to trim that back without...
In the winter, you know, what passes for winter in your part, you can go in and selectively remove branches. And to do that, you want to, if the branch is really long, you take it off in foot-long sections. Then when you get close to the tree, you cut close to the tree, but not too close. You want to leave the branch collar connected to the tree, so there's like a little stub coming out. And then if the tree gets so productive it's bending under its own weight, just take off some of the fruits.
Okay.
Especially early in the season, there's nothing wrong with thinning the fruits so that there's, you know, a reasonable number of pomegranates on the tree. And you know that you can tell they're ripe when they change color. And if
No, I did not know that.
Okay, so they're going to change color, and then the weirdest thing is when you ping them with your finger, the sound will change so it sounds like you're banging off a car door, like a piece of metal. And that's when they're ripe. And my friend Lee Reich says, because, you know, they're so messy. You know, you can't eat a pomegranate in decent company because you're spitting the seeds all over the place. He says what he does is he takes one and he rolls it around in his hand until it's all kind of mashed up a little bit inside. And then he pokes a drinking straw into it and sucks out the juice that way.
That is the oddest thing. I like that. I'm going to have to try that.
He's the oddest person I know, but he's a good source of information. All right. You enjoy those two trees.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had. Dave, where are you?
Well, I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and I'll pull over in order to talk to you on You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Where are you driving through?
Well, in western Pennsylvania at the moment, but my question pertains to where my wife and I live, which is up in the St. Lawrence Valley of northern New York.
Oh, it's beautiful up there, man.
Right in there between the Thousand Islands and the Adirondack Mountains.
Yeah, that must be a glorious view. All right, what can we help you with in upstate New York?
Well, we have a 54-acre horse farm, and we like to say that we're organic and like to keep it as chemical-free as possible, but this summer we've been kind of inundated with some yellow jackets that seem to think the horse barn is the place to build their nest or their swarm.
Yeah, yellow jackets are really mean. I'm always defending native bees, and we're always trying to get people to understand the difference between ground nesting native bees, which mostly nest in the spring and they're totally harmless, and yellow jackets, which tend to be more prominent. Their nests are more pronounced in the late summer and early fall. Yellow jackets, I feel strongly, are responsible for every, quote, bee sting death in America. They are highly aggressive hornets. And at this time of year, each nest can contain many thousands of yellow jackets. Some large nests may have 10,000 workers in them. And whether, you know, and I can just imagine the terror if a horse accidentally steps on their nest, because they'll just pursue that horse relentlessly.
Right.
You have two excellent options if you can run electricity out there. And I would think on a farm your size, you can even run a generator out to a place if you need to, right?
Okay, we have electric, and they have decided that they want to build their nest in between the inner and outer walls of one of our horse stalls.
Right, okay, so this is perfect then. So what you do, you need a helper for this. The helper has a can of Pam or other, you know, low-fat oil spray for, like, cooking. So you're going to approach the nest early in the morning when it's the coolest, like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and she's going to be there. If any workers come out to check you out, she just sprays them with the oil. It'll coat them and they'll die. And you set up an old Electrolux or other canister vacuum cleaner, and you plug it in. And then when the weather warms up, you get to the vacuum. You may have to tape it to the wall or put it on a table or something, but you get the hose near the nest. And then when the weather gets warm that day, you turn it on, and all of the yellow jackets will attack this roaring monster. One by one, they will literally empty the nest and fly to their doom inside the canister vacuum. And after you've had an hour with no yellow jackets coming out of the nest, you put duct tape over the hose, turn the vacuum off, let it sit in the sun for a day, and that nest is done. That nest is emptied.
That's brilliant. That's outstanding.
The other is one of my favorites. Have you seen these mosquito-killing, light bulbs at night, the electrified things that are supposed to kill mosquitoes at night?
The zappers.
Yeah, the bug zappers. Unfortunately, they don't work on mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are not attracted to the light. But same thing. If you can set one of these up next to the hole in the wall or next to a nest and turn it on, the yellow jackets will attack that light and that buzzing until there's probably going to be 6 inches of dead yellow jackets at the base, and they will throw themselves to the last yellow jacket into the jaws of death. And you didn't have to use any poisons. They emptied the nest, and they won't reuse that nest the following year.
Well, those are two outstanding ideas for the yellow jackets in the wall of the stall.
Yep. So good luck, Dave. Be careful. And realize that these oil sprays are a variation on horticultural oil, which is an old school way to kill insects. And all you have to do is hit them with a little stream of one of these cooking oils, and they can't fly anymore, and it smothers them. So it's a great way to protect you while you set up the big device.
Yay, and no poisons involved.
No poisons. Nope. You don't need them. We can take care of any problem without poisons. That's why we're here, Daveski.
All right. We love it, Mike. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Love
my pleasure.
Show.
You drive safe, pal.
All right. Good buddy. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Hope, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today. Hope, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine as well.
And where is Hope Fine?
I am in Mount Airy.
A beautiful place in Philly. What can we do for Hope in Mount Airy?
Well, I have always wanted crepe myrtles. And so I found three. Maybe you could tell me the best way to plant them.
Where did you get your crepe myrtles?
At a local garden center.
Good, good, good. Are these dwarf or semi-dwarf, do you know?
One of them is a dwarf, I believe. It's only going to grow to be 4 to 6 feet, I believe they said, and it's got bronze leaves.
Oh, sounds nice.
So it's going to be like a bush, yeah, and I got all deep pink ones. There's a tall one that's going to grow to be almost 15 feet,
right,
and another tall one that's only going to grow to be about 12.
Okay, so you have a dwarf and two semi-dwarfs, because you've seen the standard size of these trees, right? I see them every year. We drive back and forth to Virginia Beach. My brother lives there. And along Route 13, there are some ancient crepe myrtles. And those things, those are standards. Those are 35, 40 feet tall.
Yeah.
But for home use, most of them have been dwarfed. And the nice thing about crepe myrtles is they can be pruned to be almost any height you want. As long as you prune them every year. But yes, they're in pots right now, I'm presuming?
Yes, they are still in pots.
Are they flowering?
Yes.
Yeah, because this is the time of year where they'd be in flower. But I'm going to be hesitant to transplant them right away. I don't like to plant things in flower, unless you think you're good at this.
I don't think I'm good at this.
Okay.
That's why I'm calling you.
So anyway, what you want to do is you want to find an area or three different areas that have real good sun.
Okay.
These plants are going to bloom best in the full sun. And you want to dig a wide hole, but not a deep one. You want to plant them at the same soil height they are in their pots. They're in pots, right?
Yeah.
So you want to plant them at the same soil line height, no lower than that. Matter of fact, you may want to examine them carefully. These may even be grafted plants. So you would see like a bulge or some area where the two plants were joined. You always want to make sure that is well above the soil line, the graft itself. Never bury the graft or you'll get the rootstock coming out. So dig a wide hole, but not a deep one, and don't fill it up with anything fancy. You're not going to fill the hole with peat moss, compost, or anything like that.
Okay.
Then when you're ready, drop them into their holes and then just fill the hole in with the same soil you removed, because you don't want to create a little island of soil where the roots are going to wrap around the plant. You want it to go out into your lousy clay soil.
That's exactly what I have.
It's what every
clay soil.
You and everybody within 100 miles of you, except for down the shore. Yeah. So you want to force the roots to go out into that clay soil. That's why we no longer improve the soil in the hole. Then you can mulch the surface of the soil with some shredded leaves or compost, but keep the plants well watered until the soil freezes hard for the season. And then in the spring, when new growth appears on the plants, give them a little haircut. These are young plants. They're not really tall yet. So just take like 6 inches off. If they're a single trunk, just take it off the top. If they're a multi-trunked shrub, take like 6 inches off of each of the individual trunks. And then they will grow over the summer. And then each successive spring, after the plants green up, prune off as much as it grew the previous year. So if it grew a foot, you take off a foot. If it grew 2 feet, you can take off a foot and a half to 2 feet. But that way you can keep the plants the size you want.
All right. That's good to know.
And otherwise, they're really easy care plants. You should have a ball with them. All right. Good luck, Hope.
Thank you, Mike.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I am coming to Dayton to team up with WYSO for a big outdoor event on Saturday afternoon, October 3rd. Then it's off to Fredericksburg, Virginia for two appearances at the Fall Home and Craft Show on Sunday, October 18th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to Compost Cub Scouts and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by HarvestRite. HarvestRite's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at HarvestRite.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now. Cats and kittens, in just a little bit, we'll be composting Cub Scouts. Actually, we'll be teaching Cub Scouts how to compost. And we'll be taking lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am very good today. Susan, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
Where is Susan pretty good?
Okay, well, right now I'm visiting my mother in Philadelphia, but I live in Teaneck, New Jersey, which is about 20 minutes from the George Washington Bridge.
Right, just across the river from New York.
That's right, that's right.
All right, what can we do for Susan from Teaneck?
So the problem is with a pear tree that we've had for about 26 or 27 years since our daughters were born. And it's very tall. I would say about 15, 18 feet. It gets partial sun and it gets blooms and lots of pears. What happens next, though, is that the pears are small and hard. The squirrels get some, but that's not the major problem, my husband thinks. They just drop.
Right, right. This is a major issue with apples and peaches that people who think they're going to grow their own fruit often are unaware of, and it takes them by surprise. But in general, fruit trees need a vigorous pruning every winter. And then when the little fruits start to form after the flowers fall, you need on peaches and apples to remove 75% of the little fruits to get big fruits at the end of the season. Pears are typically lesser care unless you have a really old tree that hasn't been really cared for a long time.
Right. I mean, we didn't realize that. So for 20-odd years, we have not been pruning this tree.
So when you do your pruning work, which I'm going to suggest you do this winter or like right before the flowers typically open, you're going to get rid of a good number of branches. You can take off up to a third of the tree, especially old wood that's not productive. Any kind of what are called water sprouts, that's a branch that goes straight up in the air.
Uh-huh.
And what you're doing will be called rejuvenation pruning, because these trees can take a hard pruning, and then what I want you to do is take off about a quarter of it safely. I mean, if it's a big tree, if it's a standard tree, make sure the ladder is sturdy. Don't let you or anybody else take off a really long branch in one piece, but take off all the old gnarly crossing branches. Try to open it up. Get rid of any suckers or water sprouts. You know, suckers are coming up from the base of the tree. Water sprouts are coming out of a branch. And then let it flower. And after it flowers, just look at the little fruits that are forming. And the ones that it's easy for you to reach, thin the fruits. That just means pulling off and composting about half of the baby fruits so that if you imagine it, you know what a full-size pear looks like, right?
Right, I do, yeah.
So between every baby pear, you want there to be room for a full-size pear.
Okay.
So you can't have like a row of marbles. And quite honestly, the more you take off, the better the fruit is going to be at the end of the season. Now, you know, once pears are full-size, you can harvest them because they really are the only fruit that is very deliberately harvested before it ripens, and then they ripen up indoors. They don't get ripe on the tree like peaches do.
So you think February, March, we should start pruning?
Yes, February would be ideal. You know, what I like to tell people about the ideal time to prune, especially big trees, is when you want to do it the least, right in the middle of winter. But that's the safest time for the tree, because it's dormant. It's like carrying a two-year-old into the house at 1 o'clock in the morning from the van. You can bang their head on a doorway or two. They're not going to wake up. They're sound asleep. Same with those trees in the middle of winter. It's hard to do permanent harm. You should be able to make dramatic improvement the first year, and you should be able to bring this puppy completely in line over 3 or 4 years.
That's great. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Susan.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Nice talking to you. Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Wendy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Wendy. Thank you so much for asking. How is Wendy doing?
Wendy is doing fine.
In?
Yardley, Pennsylvania.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Wendy in the land of yards?
Well, Mike, I live in a townhouse community, and we have landscaping contractors who take care of our property.
My God, I'm so sorry for you.
I know. Well, last April, they accidentally put herbicide down on our lawn, and they completely killed our lawn to the point where we had nothing but dirt. So in October, they came around and put sod down, and then, you know, we had a pretty snowy winter, and the snow sat on the sod all winter long. And then in the spring, the sod looked good for about maybe the month of April, slowly started dying, and now I have giant patches of nothing but dirt. So my question is, how long will this chemical stay in the ground, and does something more need to be done? Like, does the whole lawn need to be dug up and replanted? Do we need to put new soil down? Can we test the soil?
Well, first of all, it's absolutely amazing that they were able to kill a lawn with herbicide, because as you probably realize, most herbicides are designed to kill everything that's not a grass plant.
Right.
So to achieve a lawn-killing herbicide, these guys are on the Death Star. I mean, they're right up there with the guys in the white armor shooting each other.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, that's a real achievement. Unfortunately, some of the more persistent herbicides can remain for quite a long time, but they are all designed to kill like shrubs and trees and weeds, not so much lawns. And did you say they installed sod in the fall?
Yes, they put sod down probably in mid-October.
That's really amazing. I can't even imagine where they would find it. Most sod farms regulate their sod, work their sod so that it's available during a big window in the spring when the soil's warm enough for planting. They harvest the sod. I don't think I've ever seen sod for sale in the fall, but theoretically, it should have worked if they had good quality sod. Now, I will tell you, and this is just also for the benefit of anybody who's thinking about doing it, one thing Nick Christians, our turf grass expert from Iowa State, explained to me is sod has to be super fresh. It's use it the same day you get it. It should come from the farm. You should have your dirt prepared. It shouldn't sit in the sun for an hour. It should be put down immediately, and then it should have the heck watered out of it, just totally saturated, but then left alone for like 4 or 5 days. So if these guys were able to kill a lawn with herbicide, it's quite possible they didn't even know how to lay sod correctly.
And that makes sense.
And they might have left it out in the sun. It might have gotten stale. They might not have watered it. Or one way to kill sod is to water it every day after installation. It's not intuitive. You got to read the research to see how to do it right.
Right.
There's two options. The lawn could be seeded very successfully right now if the herbicide is out of the soil. And it should be. We got a good amount of rain over the summer. So this would be an excellent time for them to spread some topsoil or some compost and spread the right kind of grass seed. A cool season lawn sown in Pennsylvania almost any time in September is going to kick. It's going to be almost bulletproof. I would not recommend sod this time of year. So, I mean, your options are good because now is the most successful time to seed a cool season lawn, and in the spring is the most successful time to lay sod for a cool season lawn. And cool season lawn just means fescue or bluegrass, the grasses that predominate here in the Northeast. And the final thing is you got to talk to the committee that hires these people and you know, talk about getting bids from a different contractor.
Yeah, well, we're hopeful that their contract will be up in December, and hopefully we will get some more confident people taking care of our property.
Go to the meetings, and I'll tell you what I want you to do beforehand. Go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. Click on Garden Answers A to Z, and then under Lawn Care, under L, there's 10 questions to ask a lawn care provider to see if you're getting the right kind of quality and the right kind of knowledge.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Well armed you should be for this.
Okay. I hear you. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Wendy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we are calling Composting Cub Scouts. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read us this week's intriguing question.
I'd be happy to, Mike. Jim, a cub master in Illinois, writes, I've listened to your podcast for a couple of years and know that you are the king of compost. That's why I'm writing. Boy Scouts of America has a new program designed to teach Cub Scouts about composting, but they're telling the kids to dig a hole in their backyard and sink a trash can with holes drilled into it into the hole. That's a big task to ask of families. Is there another way they can make their own compost out of food scraps? I'm attaching the Scout handout on the trash can method. How would you go about teaching 8-year-old youngsters about composting?
Well, the handout that Jim sent really does say to get an adult to drill holes in a metal trash can and sink it into a foot-deep hole in your backyard.
Seems like a waste of a good trash can to me. And then does it say to fill it with food scraps?
Yeah, and you know, that's probably why they came up with this system. They want to focus on composting food scraps, which makes a lot of sense. Every house has them, and they seem easy to recycle to the untrained eye. And so the metal trash can with a specified tight-fitting lid is almost certainly designed to discourage rats, mice, raccoons, and other vermin from showing up at the table. But in northern parts of the country, filling an outdoor trash can with kitchen waste just as winter approaches is going to produce ruined trash cans filled with frozen garbage in the spring.
Which is going to send an incorrect message that composting doesn't work. Because as you always warn, a composter filled with kitchen garbage is probably always going to remain a composter filled with kitchen garbage. Do they talk about adding anything else?
Oh yeah, it's a list of the usual suspects. One-third kind of good ideas, one-third really bad ideas, and one-third good ideas that just need a little more explanation and detail to work.
Let me guess, grass clippings, but no warning that the finished compost can kill plants if the lawn was treated with herbicides.
And fall leaves with no mention of shredding them. And as we always warn, whole leaves tend to mat down and resist composting.
Okay, what are the really bad ideas?
How about pine needles? Hey kids, let's make compost with sharp edges. What fun! And cardboard. Now, you can use the shredded paper that's also on the list. It doesn't contain any nutrients, but it is a, quote, dry brown that will help move the kitchen waste along. But this is the first time I think I've ever seen cardboard on one of these lists. And I thought I'd pretty much seen it all by now. I'm not even sure how you would begin to shred cardboard. Anyway, every community has a place where you can drop off paper and cardboard to be recycled. And that's what the Scouts should be encouraging. Compost piles are not trash cans.
These ones are.
Oh, right, I forgot that. Anyway, the basic problem here is that recycling kitchen waste is pretty tricky to do. The two best methods are an indoor worm bin or mixing small amounts into big piles of shredded leaves that are protected from vermin. Yes, I know many of our listeners just mix their garbage into big piles of unprotected leaves outdoors, and that's fine. But a big organization like the Scouts can't and should not suggest anything that might attract rats to a house. So here's one idea that tries to buy into this trash can concept. They say to drill small holes in the bottom of the can. I'm going to suggest making the holes big. Or using a plastic trash can and cutting the bottom out entirely. Then shove it just a few inches into the ground to make it easy for earthworms to come and go. It doesn't have to be a foot deep. Put some fruit and vegetable waste in the bottom, and then cover it with either shredded newspaper, which is better than no brown material at all, or ideally a layer of shredded fall leaves. Then continue, making sure the layers of shredded leaves or paper are 2 to 3 times the amount of the kitchen waste.
Huh, okay, kind of an outdoor worm bin, using earthworms instead of the red wrigglers that go into indoor worm bins.
Yeah, and this basic concept works really well for me in those big black plastic composters that have locking lids. And maybe the kids can talk a parent or older sibling into stirring the contents a couple of times, especially before winter shuts it down. Of course, having a real worm bin indoors would work much better.
But these are 8-year-olds who, come to think of it, would probably love watching worms eat their garbage. Do you have any other options?
Yes. Next season, issue a nationwide challenge to see which den can build the biggest pile of shredded leaves in the fall. Maybe let them add coffee grounds as they go, but nothing else. Then count how many wheelbarrows of finished compost each group has made just before the scouting breaks for the summer. Those scouts would keep tons of leaves out of the waste stream, and they'd make enviable amounts of compost. Well, that sure was some good advice about composting Cub Scouts now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to purloin my patches if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email with your location. You're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore. With your location at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, but where you will find the answers to all of those questions you are going to send in your email, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Griffin. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz is the Weeblo of our website. Ambassador Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY in Philadelphia. Barish L. Banks is our editor. Star Scout Stephen Drehobel is our indomitable intern. I'm your host, Eagle-ish, Mike McGrath. No, that's not Eagle Scout, just Eagle-ish. Kind of like truthiness, but I get to wear a sash. Anyway, I'll start a fire with two sticks, help an old lady across the street, find my own way out of the woods, and study up on scat until I can see you again. Are you worried about the emerald ash borer annihilating your arboretum? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll examine your organic options for keeping this tree-killing pest at bay, plus your fabulous phone calls.